By the end of this video, you're gonna know exactly what it's like to live on Earth 40,000 years from now in the grimdark future. And spoiler warning, it's pretty f***ing horrifying. Now, if you're brand new to Warhammer 40K, one of its core themes is that it's supposed to be a new dark age for humanity, and misery is kind of the norm here. Now, everything is taken to its extremes, and the Earth is no exception. It's like every dystopian nightmare you've ever read about all merged together and then wrapped up in a tasteful amount of religious fanaticism, and then all those elements are cranked up to 11. By this point in time, Holy Terra, as it has come to be known, doesn't look anything like the Earth that we know. It is a toxic, irradiated cesspit, plagued by mile-tall clouds of smog that stretch from pole to pole. Literally every square inch of the planet has become dominated by a single massive supercity that climbs both miles into the sky and miles beneath the dirt. There are no oceans, no forests, no natural resources, as all of these were sacrificed thousands of years ago. The population itself is said to be so ludicrously out of control that some estimates put it into the unthinkable realm of the quadrillions. Despite what a horrific cesspit the Earth has become, it is still the single most holy planet out of the million worlds controlled by humanity. It is the beating heart of the Imperium, a galaxy-spanning empire that is locked in a never-ending war for survival against the unholy trinity of the heretic, the alien, and the mutant. But how did it all get this way? How did a planet that attracts literally billions of pilgrims every single year due to its spiritual significance become such a hellish place to live? What caused the planet to slip so far from the Emperor's original vision of a utopian paradise for mankind? What is life like for the average civilian living here, and what is the true population of our planet in the 41st and 42nd millennia? Well, needless to say, we've got a lot to talk about. So strap yourself in and let's dive headfirst into the grimdark to figure out what it's really like to live on the birth world of our species 40,000 years in the future. But first, I want to take a minute to talk about the importance of taking care of your mental health with the sponsor of today's video, BetterHelp. Now, therapy's been an important tool that I've personally utilized throughout my life to deal with things like my ADHD, generalized anxiety disorder, or at one point in my life, even an entire year where I couldn't go a single day without having a panic attack. And let me tell you, having your brain suddenly turn on your fight or flight response without any kind of clear cause made living a normal life incredibly difficult for me. But through therapy, I learned all kinds of ways to prevent them from spiraling out of control. From breathing exercises to meditative techniques, removing myself from certain situations, or even simple things like always having a cold water bottle on hand to ground myself with. And although admittedly, I do still have some anxiety, through therapy, I haven't had a panic attack in many years. Now, BetterHelp makes finding a therapist uniquely tailored to your needs more convenient and affordable than ever before. Sessions can be done from the comfort of your own home, via phone, computer, phone call, video chat, or messaging. It's whatever feels the most comfortable for you. And if you think you might be someone that would benefit from therapy, then click on my link in the description of this video, which will take you to a quick questionnaire that will help them match you with a therapist, usually within 48 hours. If you use my link or choose the Wes Hammer option during sign up, you'll save 10% off your first month. Big thanks to BetterHelp for sponsoring this video. The ancient imperial records indicate that Holy Terra, or Earth, as it was once more commonly known, used to be a lush and shining jewel of a planet, dominated by vast and beautiful oceans and verdant thriving forests. The skies and seas were said to be filled with exotic plants and animals that coexisted in a complex, self-sustaining ecosystem alongside the fledgling ancestors of our species. As the planet's human population grew and became more technologically savvy, they carved out bustling cityscapes and centers of industry, taming the wilds and asserting their dominance as the world's supreme life forms. By the year 42,000, however, the cradle of humanity has become completely unrecognizable. Every gift the planet gave us, every natural resource, every body of water, every plant and animal has all been sacrificed on the anvil of progress. Humanity drained the Earth's oceans, leveled its mountain ranges, and burned every last inch of forest to make room for more manufactorums, hyperdense hab zones, and suffocating mountains of rockcrete. As mankind's population increased exponentially, so too did its greed and means of production. No matter how much we took, it was never enough. Our greed never curbed, and our hunger never satiated. The Terra of the 41st and 42nd millennia is as much a planet as it is a single never-ending megacity. a labyrinthian sprawl of layers upon layers of spires, vaults, habwarren, scriptoriums, crypts, and temples that stretch both miles into the sky and deep beneath the earth, all woven together in a tangled mess of wrought iron and plasteel, built atop the decaying ruins of the cities that came before. The sheer overwhelming weight causing it all to sink deeper and deeper into the toxic mires beneath with every passing year. At this point, there isn't a single square inch left that has gone untouched by the hand of man, and with that touch came 10,000 years worth of contamination and the scars of countless wars that mar the carcass of humanity's cradle with our sinful legacy. By command of both the Adeptus Terra and the Ecclesiarchy, this ancient battle damage will never be repaired. These sites where the Emperor's sons and their armies stood against the darkness now exist as points of reverence for the faithful. Every plasma burn admired, every crater revered, even the carcasses of enemy titans that marched on the palace during the Siege of Terra have been left where they were slain, a constant reminder to the faithful of the God Emperor's wrath. Although precious few pilgrims will ever be granted the honor of seeing it firsthand, the most holy place on the entire planet is said to be just outside of the Eternity Gate, where the Great Angel fell. It never rains on Terra. It's suffocatingly hot and humid wherever you go. What little sunlight manages to pierce the world's toxic clouds bathes the steel and rockcrete structures below in a thin, sickly layer of dirty light. Most of the world's illumination instead comes from the countless torches, church braziers, and marker lumens blinking in their millions. Viewed from space, the planet's night-shrouded hemisphere glitters with constellations of neon and sulfur, while its sunlit hemisphere gasps in a hot haze of pale gray. Its skies are clogged with void crafts and lifters in their millions, packed full of commodities stolen from a million worlds to keep the writhing masses from starving themselves. Although none would blaspheme out loud against the throne world, many consider it to exist as a realm of contradictions. No jewel shines more brightly, and no canker is more foul. It is the epicenter of both mankind's fears and glories, our cradle and our tomb, a monument to both our dreams and hubris, and a site of both extreme wealth and unimaginable poverty. Despite all this, Terra remains the most holy and revered place in the entire galaxy, attracting pilgrims in their billions and a never-ending migration. They travel here from every corner of the Imperium, desperate only to live long enough to catch a fleeting glimpse of the sacred precincts of the Imperial Palace, a continent-sized temple that dominates old Asia and houses the master of mankind. It is here that the God Emperor sits upon his golden throne, locked in a never-ending spiritual conflict with the ruinous powers. Should the throne ever fail, should the God Emperor ever be allowed to die, the long-postponed extinction of our species will surely follow. Now, most of the pilgrims that will attempt this journey will unfortunately never make it, and most will end up dying of old age out in the void or get stuck within the solar system's processing pens and vast orbitable stations for decades. It is said that a man could be born, live, and die within those cavernous holding centers, all while his documentation worked its way torturously through the offices of the Administratum, passing through the hands of countless scribes, underscribes, and bureaucratic chambers. Often such documents would be lost, sometimes stolen, a mere speck amid the avalanche of parchment folios that fueled the administrative machinery of the Imperium. This is a great passage from the Carrion Throne that talks about what this looks like from the point of view of an aircraft traveling above it all. Below them, 1,000 lesser aircrafts plied the filth-trailed passages from spire to spire, feeding the gritty haze that shrouded the depths below. Marker lumens, red and filmy, blinked by the million, faint beacons amid a sea of perpetual murk. Above them, just visible against the bone gray of the sky, were the shadows of the Sentinel watch stations hanging in low orbit, each crammed with listening devices and auger batteries, forever scanning. Above them, in turn, were the behemoths of the defense grid, some as old as the Imperium itself. And above them, out in the icy vacuum, were the void ships, millions of them, embarking, arriving, or engaged in ceaseless patrols. Spinoza had served with Tur on major hive worlds, but the multitudes here were still numbing. She looked down, watching the airborne fleets mingle and congest, and knowing that below, far below, ground cars and grav transits were crawling through stack-deep tunnels and catacombs, ferrying far more souls than could ever hope to afford privileged above-ground passage. She also knew that what she witnessed was the same on every single square kilometer of the world's surface. There were no forests, no seas, just an unbroken press of spires, hab towers, temples, jails, crypts, and garrisons, grasping and throttling the entire globe in a vice of iron and rockcrete. If you're brand new to Warhammer 40K, then it's important to know that Terra didn't always used to be this way. As we all know, in our modern times, the planet certainly has its problems, and we're not exactly doing our best to curb any of those. But by comparison to the terror of the 41st and 42nd millennia, it's night and day. By the time of the Dark Age of Technology, in and around the year 18,000, it is said that Earth had, for the most part, become something of a utopia. As our technology had progressed to such ludicrous levels, basically everything was possible. Overpopulation was certainly an issue, but at this point in time, we were sending out millions of colony ships in each and every direction that ferried large groups of people out into the void to establish new worlds. However, with the coming of the Age of Strife, that would all change, and humanity would end up entering a new Dark Age. Although we're not given a lot of insight into this particular period of human history, it is said that Earth was basically turned into a wasteland that was ruled over by various techno-barbarian factions that warred over the ancient technology that was left behind. Now, this would all begin to change with the coming of the Emperor and the Unification Wars, as he was actually making great strides to rebuilding the planet. If you're a big lore buff that likes to read the books set in the Horus Heresy period, which was around the year 30,000, and then all of the more modern 40K novels that take place in the 41st and 42nd millennium, there's a pretty huge difference between the Terra depicted in both of these series, especially in the early Horus Heresy books before the war fully got underway. Now, overpopulation during the 30th millennium was certainly an issue, just like earlier periods in history, but all of the pieces were being put back together. Humanity was making huge strides in terms of technology, there had been a renaissance in the subjects of art and literature, and the Emperor was in the process of reviving the Earth's forests, oceans, plants, and animals. However, the aforementioned Horus Heresy, the bloodiest civil war in mankind's history, and the resulting final battle that would see the Emperor of Mankind entombed upon the Golden Throne, would forever derail humanity's path towards his idealized future. The species never really recovered from this, and would become gripped by fear and superstition that, over the next 10,000 years, would cause the throne world to slip further and further into a state of rot and entropy, all while its soaring spires and overpopulated habdomes pressed higher and higher into its toxic, smog-soaked skies. It should go without saying that if you're one of the quadrillions of individuals lucky enough to be born within humanity's cradle, your life most likely sucks. It's said that you can immediately spot somebody born of Terra, as they all have a characteristic gray, ashen skin and sickly appearance. The throne world gray, as it is called, is indicative of the extreme poverty of lowborn life. Disease is rampant in the lower hives, the air, water, and food all poisonous, and needless to say, the average life expectancy for such people rarely exceeds 40 years. The people of this world have a saying that they use pretty often, quote, "This is Terra." It's a mantra used when no further explanation was required or could even be given. In many respects, it's the grimdark equivalent of a more modern saying popular amongst millennials, "It is what it is." Now, Terra is admittedly a very big place, and where you end up being born does play a role in your overall quality of life. You could, for instance, be born into one of the noble households, the ancient and powerful families that live in the world's highest spires, where you will live a life of lavish luxury and may even have access to actual air conditioning, something that is an inconceivable luxury to the people of the lower spires. But considering that your odds of being born into one of these houses is one in multiple trillions, that's probably not going to happen. You're much more likely to end up in the lower or under hives. If you end up being born into the lower hives, you will at the very least be given a sense of purpose as a cog in the Imperial War Machine, predetermined long before your birth by multiple generations of your ancestors, who have all done the exact same thing dating back thousands of years. The dregs of society, on the other hand, will cling to existence in their billions in the eternal darkness of the subterranean underhive, amidst the ancient fossilized hab structures of cities forgotten by history. A fun fact, the underhives of Terra are not abandoned like the underhives of many other hive worlds. This subterranean realm is home to trillions of people. It is a realm of toxic warrens, rampant disease, and voracious predators where mutation is commonplace. Life down here is violent, miserable, and oftentimes mercifully short. The majority of the people living on Terra, whether they're born into the lower hives or the underhive, will never once leave the enclosure of the megalithic spires they are born into. Even those that do leave at some point will most likely never even see the sky. For no matter where they stand, the view above them will be blotted out by a seemingly infinite array of crisscrossing causeways, footbridges, transit tubes, and multi-layered viaducts. If you were to look up in such a place, you would see millions of aircrafts and mile-long armored trains weaving through all of the rockcrete spires, each just one of thousands of supply drops that pass every hour, ferrying their massive payloads across a famished world. This passage from the Carrion Throne gives us a good look into the life that can be expected for most of Terra's population. They would be born into the industrial natal units, ripped from their mothers at the earliest opportunity to be sprayed with disinfectant and branded with time and location stamps. They would be educated in the Spire's indoctrination units in classes 500 strong, where priests and scholars bearing electroprods would bellow out the list of the fallen for memorization and impress the sacred trinity of fears, the alien, the heretic, and the mutant. At the age of 10 standard, most would be assigned work details, taking into account any particular aptitude, a position in a low-level manufactura, food tank processors, engineering squadrons, or refuse collection. The more gifted would be given assignments in the Spire's myriad security and control organizations, or service the tower's colossal eternal life support systems. The most gifted of all would end up in Hirin Valko's position, tiny cogs in the Adeptus Terra's unimaginably vast web of administrators. Many more would again fall between the cracks entirely, living a precarious life in the grimy shadows, feeding on the unwary, hunted by the overburdened arborators, an existence little better than that of the beasts which had once shared Terra's poisoned biosphere. No matter their station, when death claimed them, their bodies would be taken down into the furnaces, their organs extracted, and their hair stuffed into sacking, and the rest fed to the greedy flames that never went out. Their eyes, now floating in preservation vials and dispatched via servitor to recycler apothecarians, would never have seen a sunrise, unfiltered by dirty plexiglass. Their skin would never have felt the brush of the world's wind. Their ears would never have been free of the endless hum of the Spire's engines and its forges. The men and women born of Terra are kept ignorant by design. They know nothing of the wider galaxy, human history, or even the spires that surround their own. But if there's one thing they are intimately familiar with, it's fear. From the moment of their birth, fear is used as a tool to control the masses. Now, fear of the enemy is one thing. The horrors of the alien, the mutant, and the heretic are drilled into them from birth. But that's not enough. The people must be also made to fear their protectors as well, in order to keep them obedient. Whether that be fear of the Adeptus Arbetes, their neighbors, the dreaded Inquisition, or even their own valuable, imperfect selves. Although such tactics have been successful in maintaining control over such a massive amount of people, it's had the secondary effect of breaking them. This is a quick quote from Inquisitor Kroll, who explains what this looks like. "Fear is like any other weapon," he said. "It can be exhausted. When you next go to the Hive Spires, look at the people. They are afraid, terrified all of the time. Every waking moment, they're gripped by anxiety. They fear the alien. They fear their neighbor. Any second of any day, they might be hauled down to the scrutiny cells by an arborator, a priest, or, Throne help them, one of us. They're numb to it. We are numb to it. We forget what the fear of the guilty looks like, for we have made innocence impossible." In addition to fear, faith plays an equally important role in maintaining control of Terra's population. In some aspects, the Adeptus Terra sees them as two sides of the same coin. Fear keeps them obedient, whereas faith keeps them loyal. It is the belief of Interrogator Spinoza in the Carrion Throne that faith was cheap for the desperate and only truly valuable for those with the strength to understand its purpose. The mania that gripped the hordes of visiting pilgrims was a powerful means of control for the Imperium. But if both fear and faith were not continuously reinforced and channeled in the right direction, the fervor of the teeming masses could be redirected to another more malevolent power. The masses believed through fear, and thus faith born from fear kept them safe. And speaking of Interrogator Spinoza, there's actually a really interesting, albeit kind of depressing scene in the Carrion Throne that illustrates this philosophy perfectly, when she encountered this ever-present fear in person for the first time. Now, in the story, she hasn't been on Terra for very long, and at one point, decides that instead of summoning a flyer to take her to her destination, she would walk the streets of the lower hive. She takes off her rebreather, and for the first time, breathes in the unfiltered air of the throne world.
It was more acrid than she imagined. A melange of promethium fumes, human stinks, moldering organics, the pyres of the faithful. She drew it in deep, feeling its acerbic grit graze against her windpipe. She had only gone a short distance from the squalor of the processing plant, and the twisting streets were already packed with humanity. Moldering bridges soared far overhead, and bridges crossed over those bridges, and more until they overlapped into the blur of distance. The crowds merged and split, men and women pushing past one another, locked within the confines of transit conduits or processionals, barely seeming to notice those around them, keeping their heads down and their faces hidden. Spinoza pushed her way through. Where they were huddled and limping, she was erect, moving with the confident gait she had been taught in Astronta. They might have been another species, those masses, a suborder worthy only of cultivating for some kind of brute sustenance. An old man blundered into her path, not noticing her armor and her signifiers until too late, and she elbowed him aside. When he saw who had shoved him, his bleary eyes went wide and he fell prostrate. "Forgive me, Lord," he croaked, cracking his forehead on the rockcrete as if in penance, flecking the road with his blood. "I did not see. Forgive me." Spinoza looked down at him. He stank like all the others, the stale, ingrained stench of a body long unwashed. They are afraid, terrified, all of the time. Shortly after this, during her walk, she encounters a defaced statue depicting a space marine, as if somebody had taken a knife to it and marred its raven-beaked helm. She looks around at the shuffling crowds, their woolen cowls drawn close about their heads and their cloth-bound feet bleeding on the rockcrete. But nobody seemed to notice this great insult to the statue. This enrages her, and she lashes out at the crowd. "Do you not see that?" Spinoza cried out, gesturing to the defaced statue. "Do none of you see that?" No one answered. Those who heard her retreated quickly, bewildered and fearful, trying to push themselves back into the herd's innards in case the fault was theirs. The greater mass did not even hear, lost in the eternal city's background roar of engine growl, bell clang, procession chant, forge burn. I found this passage really interesting because oftentimes we think of civilian populations within 40K, especially those on the Holy Throne World itself, as being deeply devoted to the Emperor, such incredibly faithful zealots that they would panic at the sight of even the tiniest of heresies, which defacing the image of one of the Emperor's angels would certainly count as. But these people are so broken, so downtrodden that they don't even notice it. And it's not for lack of faith, it's that they are so wretched that when it's brought to their attention, they can only think to hide. The Imperium has done to them exactly what it was designed to do, reinforce their fears to the point where that's all they're capable of feeling. If you'll forgive me a small side tangent, when I read all of this for the first time, it immediately made me think of Conrad Kurz and Nostromo. And now, this isn't a video about the Night Lords, but it's interesting to note that Kurz also decided that the best way to rule his planet was through fear. He would hunt criminals in the night and then torture and mutilate their bodies, stringing them up for the entire world to see. These acts were horrific, but they were successful in curbing the crime rates on the planet until they were practically non-existent. But the moment the Night Haunter left the planet for the Emperor's Great Crusade, Nostromo slipped back into its old ways. It's a pretty prevalent theme throughout his story arc that although his fear-based methods of ruling made sense on paper, they were ultimately ineffective, horrific, and only sustainable so long as they were continuously reinforced. He's not painted as being a good guy, and his philosophy is meant to be horrifying to the reader. Yet, here on Terra, 10,000 years later, we see similar tactics being utilized. The only difference being those public executions are instead taking place within the holding cells of the Inquisition, and there is a veritable army of enforcers that never allow that fear to subside for even a moment. Anyway, tangent over and back to the topic at hand. Without getting into spoiler territory, there's another scene in the Carrion Throne where people living in the Underhive are being hunted by truly sadistic packs of monsters. In just a few weeks, thousands of them have been slaughtered, yet nothing has been done to stop the killings. None of the Imperium's forces will address the issue. Their protectors simply take the pleas for deliverance as the rantings of lunatics. Many who attempted to report these incidents to the authorities ended up being abducted and tortured by the Inquisition. These people live in fear of both the predators that hunt them and the people that are supposed to protect them, but won't lift a finger to do so. And there's nothing they can really do about it. They don't have access to weapons to protect themselves, they can't report such findings to the authorities, and if they try to organize into something of a civilian militia to hunt down their killers, the Adeptus Arbetes would be sent to crush them, as that would be an organization outside of the Imperium's control. and the Adeptus Terra won't allow that. From their perspective, it's far too big of a risk. A tiny spark of dissent, the briefest of flirtations with sedition, the very concept that the people could rule themselves or even handle a single issue like this better than the High Lords could ignite a firestorm that spreads through the masses like wildfire through tinder. Sinful ideas like unions, splinter coalitions, or even the dreaded democracy cannot be allowed to fester in the hearts and minds of Terra's teeming masses. If that means large sections of the population dying incredibly violent deaths, well, from the Adeptus Terra's perspective, it's better to die in purity than live in corruption. In recent times, Terra has become more dangerous than at any other point in Imperial history, save the Siege of Terra itself. In only a couple of dozen years, we've seen a demonic invasion of Cornate demons manifest and assault the Lion's Gate, a full-scale gene-stealer cult uprising from beneath Terra's underhives, and even a Dark Eldar homunculus unleash an army of grotesques in the lower hives and assault the Imperial Palace itself from beneath. Because of all this, the iron grip the Imperium must rule its teeming masses with has potentially never been more suffocating. And speaking of those teeming masses, throughout this video, we've talked about just how unbelievably overpopulated Terra actually is. And it makes sense. It's literally a planet-wide city. But exactly how overpopulated are we actually talking? Just how many people currently live on Earth in the 41st and 42nd millennia, depending on what book you're reading at the time? Well, in traditional Games Workshop fashion, they've never exactly been clear on this. They've never given us definitive figures that we can use, thus leading to near constant debate back and forth within the Warhammer 40K community for decades. However, semi-recently, we did get a couple of novels that have excerpts that mention the state of the population being in the quadrillions, those sources being the Watcher of the Throne, the Emperor's Legion, and Vaults of Terra, the Carrion Throne. But is this actually true? Has the Earth somehow managed to become that ludicrously overpopulated while staving off a mass extinction of our species? Now, on paper, a population in the quadrillions doesn't make any sense. The Earth as we know it can't support a population that big. Thus, this statistic has been commonly used as a source of ridicule that's directed at the authors of the franchise. Many Warhammer fans like to say that the Black Library authors don't know what they're talking about, and tend to just play fast and loose with big numbers that sound cool, without putting any kind of thought into the science behind them. And in fairness, this definitely does happen from time to time, especially in the more outdated or obscure parts of the lore. But if you know me, then you know that I'm not the type of person to take something in an official source and just declare it as not true. I don't like writing stuff off like that. It's way more fun to hyper-obsess over the tiniest of details and do days or weeks worth of research trying to figure out how to make it make sense rather than just accepting it and moving on or dismissing it offhand. I promise you, I'm fun at parties, I swear. So let's explore this a bit deeper and find out the true population of Holy Terra in the 42nd millennium. Although there have been tons of different studies done on calculating the Earth's theoretical maximum sustainable population, most of them tend to come in around the maximum number of around 8 billion people, whereas a number between 2 or 4 billion would be ideal to maintain a decent quality of life for everyone. Unfortunately for us, we just ticked over 8 billion people relatively recently, and we're expected to hit 9 billion before 2050. There is some evidence to suggest that the population might stabilize at that point due to declining birth rates worldwide, but that's a topic for a different video. However, the major problem with us as 40K fans trying to use these studies when looking at Terra is that these studies are looking at the Earth as it exists right now, with its oceans and mountain ranges intact, as well as the required dedicated farmland that would be needed to produce food for the population. They're not calculating in an Earth that has a million other worlds capable of endlessly shipping resources back to it, and a ruling faction that couldn't care less about the quote-unquote quality of life of the teeming masses. Terra as it exists in the 42nd millennium doesn't produce anything that will be shipped off-world. Everything made here is immediately used and consumed by Terra itself. In fact, the only thing the throne world does is consume. The Imperial Tithe states that the million worlds of the Imperium must contribute around 15% of everything they make to the Imperium, the primary benefactor of these tithes being the throne world, which just sucks it all up. Because so much wealth and resources are being funneled into this place, it has caused an inconceivable gap between the planet's wealthiest inhabitants and those at the bottom of the hierarchy, It is a planet of extreme wealth and ludicrous poverty taken up to the grimdark levels of insanity. This is another passage from the Carrion Throne that examines this in more grimdark detail, and I'm including it here because, quite frankly, I think it goes really hard. The throne world did not trade with the rest of the Imperium. It consumed it. Goods were sucked in from every corner of every segmentum, dragged out from the holds of the leviathans that carried them, seized by the ravenous population, and devoured. And it was never enough. A million cargo lifters might touch down in a single hour, and still thousands would starve. Any delay in the endless circular passage, and tens of thousands would die. Like a hopeless opiate addict, the populace could never be satisfied, never given enough. The birthplace of humanity now squatted like some obscene, famished infant at the heart of its web of stellar kingdoms, ingesting the last dregs of energy out of the straggling fringes and gulping them down into greedy oblivion. Okay, so the needs of the planet's insane population are taken care of by the rest of the Imperium. Thus, land that would be dedicated to producing such resources can be removed for more livable space. And at this point in time, that's all there is on Terra. The throne world is what is known as an ecumenopolis, a term coined by Greek architect and urban planner, and I'm going to butcher this name, Konstantinos Doxiadis, in the early 1960s to mean a planet-wide city. So over the years, literally every single city that existed on Terra just kept growing exponentially until they all started to merge together into this unthinkable megacity that just kept growing higher and deeper. It's kind of what's happening over in Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas right now. I've got family that's in that area, and it always blows me away that these used to be two distinct cities that just kind of merged into one at one point. Like, that's a totally normal thing to do. Anyways, this means that quite literally every square inch of the planet is covered by a hyper-dense urban sprawl that stretches miles into the sky and miles deep beneath the earth into subterranean warrens. As ridiculous as such a city is, it doesn't get to the meat and potatoes of exactly how many people live here. In order to figure that out, we need to know Terra's population density, i.e. the average amount of people living within every square mile. Now, I've spent the last couple of days trying to figure this out myself by using real-world examples, and although several massively populated areas could certainly be used to calculate this, there exists no better example of a real-world hive than the infamous walled city of Kowloon. If you're unfamiliar with it, this was an extremely densely populated and largely ungoverned enclave of China within the boundaries of Kowloon City, British Hong Kong. It started off as an Imperial Chinese military fort whose territories were leased to the United Kingdom in 1898. Its population increased dramatically as it was taken over by refugees, and eventually the British decided that instead of trying to police the area, they would just say screw it and let it get taken over. It wasn't worth their time. Its story is actually insanely interesting, and the channel Places 302 here on YouTube made an excellent video on it if you want to know more about it. I'll throw a link for it down in the description below. Anyways, at its height in the year 1990, the population of the walled city was estimated at around 35,000 people. Now, considering its relatively small footprint of about 6.4 acres, when scaled up, it had a population density of 3,500,000 people per square mile. Okay, so that's the first number that we're going to need. The second one is how big is the Earth itself? And that's estimated at being around 197 million square miles. So now that we have some actual numbers to work with, it's time for some more iconic Wes Hammer, definitely inaccurate quick maths. Okay, so if we assume the entirety of Terra has the same population density as the walled city, we can multiply 197 million by 3.5 million. And when we do, we get 689 trillion 500 billion people. That's a pretty ridiculous figure that would certainly cause all of those fancy scientists that estimate global population metrics to weep uncontrollably. But we're not talking about vaguely realistic figures here. This is the grimdark future, baby. We can go way harder than that. When we look back at the walled city, its largest habitable structures were about 14 stories tall. But we know that hive cities can reach multiple miles in height, Hive Primus over on Necromunda, for example, being 10 miles tall at its highest peak, and the walls of the Imperial Palace on Terra being upwards of 50 kilometers tall. Now, in fairness, when we look at a hive city, every single square inch of it is not trying to cram as many people in as possible. Some areas of the city are going to be more vastly populated than others. Hab blocks in the lower hive are going to have astronomically more people crammed into them than the hoity-toity spires that the rich nobles live in. Likewise, there still has to be room for massive manufactorums, some of them large enough that warlord titans could actually walk through them. So let's go hyper-conservative here and say that the megacity that sprawls across Terra's surface is about 1 mile tall, and at least as densely populated as the walled city, even though in reality, it's probably far worse. We won't even factor in the orbital platforms above or the miles of subterranean warrens. Okay, so with those parameters set, we can upscale the walled city's 14-story tall buildings to be 1 mile tall. 14 stories roughly equates to 196 feet, and there's 5,280 feet in a mile. So if we divide 5,280 by 196, we get 26.93878. And for simplicity's sake, we'll just scale that up to the Hives of Terra being 27 times taller and thus 27 times more densely populated than the walled city. Now we'll take our previous estimate of 689 trillion 500 billion people living on Terra and multiply it by 27. And when we do, we get a whopping population of 18 quadrillion 616 trillion 500 billion people, which 100% confirms the estimated population range of the quadrillions. And again, this is me being super conservative here. If we were to extend the hive structures to 5 miles on average with a single mile of subterranean habs, the number would push to over 100 quadrillion. Anyways, take all this with a grain of salt, as we're still lacking a lot of information when it comes to the throne world. But as these quick maths demonstrate, a population stated at being in the quadrillions is 100% possible for a hive city that spans the entire Earth. The stated figure of 18 quadrillion actually being a pretty conservative estimate. Now, obviously the Earth itself isn't capable of sustaining such a massive population, but so long as there are adequate shipments from the Imperium's million worlds, humanity will continue to exist here. And don't get it twisted, exist is the key word, as life here is pretty bleak. And based on the horrifying depictions we get in the Carrion Throne, it's, in all likelihood, the worst place in the entire galaxy that a person could live on, barring a demon world. Now, personally speaking, I think I'd rather take my chances on a death world, where I have to fight off 30-foot-tall carnivorous plant monsters, than live in the disease-riddled filth and squalor of the Terran Underhives. But what do you think of all this? What do you think it would be like living on a planet with literally quadrillions of people? Do you think the depictions we're given do such a wild concept justice? Or do you think Games Workshop has played a little too fast and loose with its science here? What do you think of Terra not having any oceans? Now, I'm no scientist, but I have a lot of questions on how that even occurred or how that works. Where did they all go? And how does a planet survive without them? This is a question I ponder at least once a week, and I probably should make a video where I figure that out. So let me know in the comment section if you would be interested in something like that. Also, if you haven't read it already, I highly suggest reading The Carrion Throne. Its audiobook version is fantastic if you prefer audiobooks. I just listened to it on a road trip recently. It's kind of what inspired this whole video in the first place. And Chris Raitt is quickly becoming one of my favorite Warhammer authors, as he seems to be somebody that really understands what this universe is really like on the micro scale for regular everyday people. Anyways, let me know all of your thoughts, questions, comments, and corrections, and ideas for future videos down in the comment section below. If you're not subscribed to the channel already, do me a favor and hit that subscribe button and ring the bell to be notified of future videos. As always, big thanks to everyone who supports the work that I do, and I will catch you all in the next one.